Time to put on our first century glasses, isn't it? We've been doing that on Sunday night for, I don't know, a couple decades. I don't remember exactly when we started, but it was some time ago. I have thoroughly enjoyed this study of Revelation, even though it'll shortly be coming to an end. But it's been very helpful to me, very encouraging, very enlightening to me, and I certainly appreciate the comments that I have gotten. Those people, those Christians in the first century had it very rough. And this message, the book of Revelation, the letter that John wrote by inspiration to those seven churches, was an encouraging one. Yes, they were being persecuted, tormented, tortured by that evil empire, that wicked Roman government, and those who were trying to enforce emperor worship, and they were going through very difficult times. And this letter was a one of encouragement. And of course, when we get to the end, as we are tonight, the end of Revelation chapter 21, it is even more encouraging. Because last time, 2 weeks ago, we looked at the first eight verses where he sees the holy city and coming down, and he talks about what kind of place it is. Now, certainly there's two things about that would be encouraging to the people in the first century. Number one, that there would be coming a time soon for them that they would not be having the kind of pain and struggles and sorrows that they had been having. But ultimately, of course, it's looking toward that day when there would be no pain, no sorrow, no death of any kind. Only a time of joy and bliss and happiness and comfort. And so that's ultimately what John is having them look forward to. They had lost friends and family members and neighbors who were Christians. And to know that they were to be ultimately in a place where there was no more pain and sorrow certainly would be a great comfort to them. And so he started describing that condition, that state that faithful Christians would be in last week in the first eight verses, in particular the first seven. And so we want to finish that chapter tonight by looking at the further description of that place, that condition, that environment, that state, and why it's going to be so wonderful. And we'll see in it a contrast in some ways between the old days of the tabernacle and temple and the new temple in heaven. So let's look, Revelation chapter 21, let's begin in verse 9. Revelation chapter 21, and let's begin around verse 9. Let's read the first couple of verses, recalling that we want to think about this as if we were living in the first century, we were Christians, experiencing persecution, what it would mean to us. John writes, "Then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls filled with the seven last plagues came to me." We've talked about this angel and the bowls, the plagues in the past. "One of them came and talked with John and said, 'Come, I will show you the bride, the Lamb's wife.' And he carried me away in the Spirit to a great and high mountain and showed me the great city, the holy Jerusalem, descending out of heaven from God." And we mentioned this a couple of weeks ago about the significance of it and the fact that we see the bride, the church, as being in its eternal home. In its eternal home. And what kind of place is that eternal home? And that's what John is describing. He described it in the first part of Revelation 21. He's going to further describe it in this section. He calls it a great city. He calls it the Holy Jerusalem. And he says in verse 11, recall, of course, that as we've mentioned, every Sunday evening, Revelation is filled with symbols and figurative language, symbolic language, and that one of the greatest abuses of this book is to take everything literally. John is describing a spiritual place, a spiritual state, a spiritual condition in words and phrases and ideas and pictures from a physical world. Well, how can you describe accurately a spiritual place with physical ideas and concepts? Well, you can't. But John does a great job. And we see that tonight. Because if I was living in the first century, I would be feeling pretty good after those first seven verses. And especially the rest of these verses in this chapter. Of course, there weren't chapters and verses when they first read them, but those words were there, and they were there to comfort. And that's certainly what they're doing. But remember, it's symbolic language. So what is there? Verse 11. This city, the holy Jerusalem, has the glory of God. Now this is what I said a while ago about contrasting the tabernacle and the temple during the time that the law of Moses was in effect had the glory of God, right? It was called, I think the Hebrew word was Shekinah, and that was the glory of God. And it was there in the tabernacle, and of course in particular there in the Ark of the Covenant. And so where the Ark of the Covenant went, then, of course, the glory of God was there. His presence was there. We're contrasting that now, though, with a place where God's presence is everywhere. His glory is everywhere. And so there's no need for an Ark of the Covenant. So we see a place that's far, far, far greater. And, of course, these people in the first century that he's writing to would know about the tabernacle and the Ark of the Covenant and God's glory and God's presence and how wonderful that would be and what it meant. And so here, just as God's glory filled those places, the tabernacle and the temple, it is filling heaven and in particular where the saints are dwelling, are going to dwell. And he says, her light was like a most precious stone. Like a jasper stone, clear as crystal. So are we saying there's actually going to be crystals and glass? Well, of course not. But this whole chapter, John is using language that the people would understand. He's using stones and items that the people were very well aware of in an effort to describe, to some extent, how beautiful, precious, valuable, great this is going to be. And for people who were suffering, who had lost so much, knowing this would be a tremendous comfort and a tremendous motivation for them to continue to be faithful. Even if it meant death, right? Revelation 2:10. Even if it meant death. Because what awaited them was so great that what they saw in this life was nothing. But John still uses the most valuable, precious, beautiful things of this world to describe how great and precious and beautiful that place is going to be. And so again, he uses that idea of physical things to describe a spiritual place. He says, also she had a great and high wall with 12 gates. And 12 angels at the gates, and names written on them, which are the names of the 12 tribes of the children of Israel. He says there's 3 gates on the east, 3 gates on the north, 3 gates on the south, and 3 gates on the west. And certainly we don't want to think that there is going to be literal gates in heaven with, as he goes ahead and describes, literal stones on them and all of this. It's not. But certainly those things mean something to us. Why did cities have walls in the first century? Well, for protection, for security. That certainly seems to be the idea John wants to convey to those Christians, was the idea of security and having that security because they're in God's presence. Not having to worry about anything. See, there won't be any anxieties in heaven. No worries, no causes to be afraid of anything. And so we have these 12 gates all around from all sides. And maybe that's the idea represented is that people from all parts of the world, maybe that's what he means by it, from all four sides. Doesn't make any difference where people live. You know, when Jesus in Matthew 8 said that people were going to come from the east and the west to enter into the kingdom. I think it's verse 11, but Matthew chapter 8. And maybe that's what he's talking about here. The idea that people will come from all parts. He mentions later about all nations. Not going to be exclusively one race like Gentiles or Jews or one country or anything else like that. People from all walks of life, old and young, rich and poor, slaves and free, all of them will be there. There's going to be access, we might say, from everywhere, from every quarter, from every direction. There's going to be a gate there. The angels were there. It says at every gate there was an angel placed. And maybe, again, the idea is to keep out anything that's evil, as he mentions later in this. And he talked with me. Well, now the wall of the city had 12 foundations, and on them were the names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb. He'd already talked about the 12 tribes of the children of Israel, and now the 12 apostles. Of course, there were, not counting Judas. Judas certainly would have no part in this. But we'd have to include Paul, right? So Paul would be number 13. So is he saying that only 12 of the 13 apostles would be? Of course not. Again, if we try to literalize everything in the book of Revelation, we'll come up with the most bizarre, unscriptural ideas imaginable. But certainly there's the idea of completeness and wholeness and perfection in every way. So we have the 12 tribes of the children of Israel. We have 12 gates. We have the 12 foundations and the names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb written on those. So again, we see the idea of people from all over, during the days of old, during the days of now, all can be in this wonderful place, this wonderful condition, this wonderful state. And sometimes I think the idea of it being a state is even more appropriate than the idea of a place. Because we're going to be in the presence of God and in His glory. So what happens? Verse 15. And he who talked with me had a gold reed to measure the city, its gates and its wall. The city is laid out as a square. Its length is as great as its breadth, and he measured the city with the reed, 12,000 furlongs. Its length, breadth, and height are equal. Then he measured its wall, 144 cubits, according to the measure of a man, that is, of an angel. There's how the city is built. Should we literalize this and say heaven is so many miles long and so many miles high? Do some people literalize it like that? Oh, yes, they do. Absolutely. You don't have to read too many different ones before you come across many people who claim this is literal dimensions. And that's the exact dimensions of heaven. Heaven's not any bigger than that. If you want to look at it in miles, it's some 1,500 miles in about each direction, approximately, made like a cube. It's all the each side and height and length are all the same. The wall was some 200 feet high or more, which isn't a particularly high wall, because some of the walls in the days of old, like you go back to Babylon and some of those, they were higher than that. Should we literalize that number and think that there's a literal wall in heaven and it's 200 and some feet high? Certainly that's not the idea John wants to convey. But again, so many literalize these numbers. But this book is written to try and describe this place, this spiritual state, this spiritual condition, this spiritual place in terms of things that these individuals in the first century would understand. They understood walls. They understood gates. They understood cities being laid out in a square. Many cities during that time were laid out in a square. So those were very familiar to the people. the size of the city is pretty impressive. You know, 1,500 miles long for a city, pretty good sized city. 1,500 miles in the other direction, that's a pretty good sized city. Certainly that's the point John wants to make. Heaven is big enough for anybody and all people who want to go there. Not going to be crowded. Going to be plenty of room. And that's all we need to make out of it. What was it made of? Verse 18. The construction of its wall was of jasper. The city was pure gold, like clear glass. The foundations of the wall of the city were adorned with all kinds of precious stones. And some of these I can't even pronounce, so I won't even attempt to. But it gives 12 different precious stones here, some of which are... This is the only place they're mentioned in the whole New Testament. And some of them, we really don't even know what they are. But he says they are precious stones. That's the point. Heaven, this condition, this state, this place, is a place that's precious. Now, the people in the first century, Christians didn't have much. A lot of it had been taken away from them. They had been persecuted and economically persecuted. They didn't have much. And so this is written again to comfort them about how great and wonderful this place is going to be. Even the gates, verse 21, the 12 gates were 12 pearls. Each individual gate was of one pearl. And the street of the city was pure gold, like transparent glass. We'll talk more about the street next Sunday evening, but each of the gates was a pearl. A real literal pearl. There are going to be real literal pearls there? No. But a pearl was precious, beautiful, valuable. And that's what he wants them to understand. This is an amazing place. But, and this is maybe the most important part, how he finishes the chapter, but I saw no temple in it. And of course, these people were very used to temples, weren't they? Temples were everywhere to all kinds of different so-called gods, and there were, from the days of old, there was, of course, the different temples that were built by Solomon and Herod and so forth. So they were used to temples. But he says here, there is no need for a temple. There's no need for a structure to worship God, to go to worship God. Why? Well, he says, for the Lord God Almighty and the Lamb are its temple. We're going to be in the presence of God. Yes, we're in the presence of God tonight in a very special way. I agree with that, and I know that. But certainly not in the way that we will be one day. 1 John 3 talks about that, doesn't it? And we're going to be one day in His presence and we're going to be like Him. We don't know exactly what that means, John says, but we know we're going to be like Him. We're going to be in His presence. There's no need for a temple. We're going to be right there in His presence. The city had no need of the sun or the moon to shine in it, for the glory of God illuminated it. The Lamb is its light. There was no need for that. No need for a temple, no need for light. No need for the sun or the moon or any type of artificial light because God is there. You know, you might say heaven's going to be one day long. Right? Not going to be any night, so it's going to be one day. A pretty long day, but it's going to be one day. Not a series of days because we think about days as day and night, day and night. No night there. It's always day. Night is sometimes the time when fear comes into people. Start thinking about things that we're afraid of, we're anxious about, we worry about. No night in heaven. None of those things. No fear, no anxieties, no worries, nothing. And the nations of those who are saved shall walk in its light. And the kings of the earth bring their glory and honor into it. Again, people from all over. All will have access. There's not going to be any eliminated from that, regardless of who they are. People from all nations, all walks of life, all socioeconomic statuses will be there. All kinds will be there. Its gates shall not be shut at all by day. Again, there shall be no night there. and they shall bring the glory and the honor of the nations into it. But there, just like he ended verse 8 of this chapter by talking about the ones who would not be in heaven, but who would suffer eternally in the lake that burns with fire and brimstone, this is how he ends this section as well, verse 27. But there shall by no means enter it anything that defiles or causes abomination or a lie, but only those who are written in the Lamb's Book of Life. Now, unfortunately, that's not true today, is it? In the church, we have people in the church who bring in defilements. We have people in the church that causes abominations. We have people in the church that lie. None of those in heaven, though. And wouldn't that be comforting to the people in the first century to know that? Would be to me. If I'm putting on those first century glasses, that's going to be a great comfort to me to know that. He had mentioned another group of people back in verse 8 that would not be there. Now he mentions others who would not be there. And in this life, just now, just like in the first century, there are people in the church who will not be in that blessed state someday in God's presence. Many of Jesus' parables talk about coming and separating those in the kingdom out. There's going to be people in the kingdom that simply don't make it. People who are defiled or that bring abominations, that lie, hypocrisy. Probably the greatest deterrent to church growth there could ever be is hypocrisy. But he says, those will by no means enter, not be allowed, but only those who are written in the Lamb's Book of Life. And ultimately, that's the only thing that matters. Ultimately, that's the only thing that matters, is whether we are written in that Lamb's Book of Life. When he opens those books, we read about that a few weeks ago, the end of Revelation chapter 20, that great judgment scene where everybody's gathered before the throne and opens the books, and we will be judged by what? What we have done in this life. Does it make a difference how we live? Absolutely. Makes a difference the decisions we make. Makes a difference because we'll be judged by those. And we can lose our name out of that book of life. Very, very clearly said throughout the Bible. The book of life, of course, goes back beginning of man. But if our name's not there, he says, we will not enter into that blessed state. So he ends verse 27, much like he ended verse 8 in that other section of this chapter. But it's really a comfort to know that those type of people will not be in heaven. It's comforting to know that murderers and the unbelievers, sexually immoral, idolaters, so forth, will not be there. It was a comfort to them, will be a comfort to us. We learn from this section that people from all walks of life can enter in. There's access for everybody if they enter it lawfully. If they enter it according to what God says. If their belief leads them to repent and their repentance leads to confession and baptism, and then they decide to lead a faithful, obedient life, even if it means giving up their life for the cause of Christ, those people will be in a blessed state in God's presence. Not at a distance, not far off, but be in God's presence, experience His glory, not for a week or a month or a few years or 1,000 years, but for that eternally long day. To me, that is a great, great message from this chapter and the book of Revelation. It's how wonderful that place is going to be, and be able to be with those type of people and with God forever. The invitation then is yours. If you want to make sure your name is in that Lamb's Book of Life, become a child of God. Be faithful throughout your life. If you need to come, we encourage you to come as we stand and sing this song.